Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 128, which is actually a panel that was held at the Immersive Architecture Conference in Venice, Italy earlier this year. So maybe about three or four weeks ago, a really fantastic conference. It was the first year that they had it. It was an architecture conference specifically focused on virtual reality and augmented reality and all the different realities, the XRs as we call them now. And it was really, really well done. It was actually surprisingly well attended to me. I mean, for such a new conference, having over 200 people there was really kind of cool. And part of that conference involved having a panel on the discussing the subject of XR and architecture. And that panel was really, really great. It was hosted by Jeff Muddle, who was really great moderator on it. Scott DeWitty was on it as well from Gensler, and he has actually been on the podcast before. Dan Harper from Cityscape was there, and Christian Klassen from D-Box, Patricia Navarro from ARX, Luciana Carvalho, from Reality Center in London, and Alon and I were both there from Chaos Group. So we discussed a lot of great things. A little bit of an apology in terms of the tech, the audio quality. Unfortunately, there was a lot of line noise that went along with the recording. So I tried to filter a lot of it out, which is still very much understandable, but it does sound a little bit like an old-timey radio feel to it. It's not normally the normal quality that you guys have expected from the CG Garage, but still really, really great content, and I hopefully you guys will enjoy it as such. As far as announcements goes, there is going to be enormous amount of announcements coming up as we get closer to SIGGRAPH. So basically what I would tell you guys to do is just keep an eye out on what's going on at SIGGRAPH. And if you are going to be at SIGGRAPH, make sure and sign up for V-Ray Days when that comes up. We'll be having pages up for all of that information coming up very, very soon. We're going to have a really great lineup of people coming up for V-Ray Days, so it should be fantastic content at that point in time. And of course, if you want more information, you can always just go to chaosgroup.com and check out our events section there and see what's going on there. Or if you want to just follow us on social, that's always an easy way to just know up-to-date news. We're available on Twitter as Chaos Group. We're available on Facebook as Chaos Group. And if you want to follow Lab Stuff, which also is currently putting out a lot of great content as well, you can follow us on Twitter as well there. That's CG_labs. And of course, if you're following this podcast, I highly encourage you to go to Facebook and follow our Facebook page there, which is CG Garage Podcast, all one word. Anyway, hopefully you guys will enjoy this really great podcast on the nature of architecture. One side, and VR, one thing I would say, which is really kind of interesting to take away from this, is for those of you who are doing VR in some way capacity, but not necessarily in the architecture world, really pay attention to what's going on here in the architecture world of VR, because this is a problem that I feel that the architecture world is actually way ahead of the curve in terms of figuring out how to use things and best case use practices of VR, because this is something that they do every day now. Patricia Navarro from ARX was basically saying at the conference that 40% of the income of his company comes from VR content. That's how much VR they make. And they're not an insignificant architecture visualization company. So there's a lot of content that they actually get paid to do in terms of virtual reality. All right, guys, hopefully you enjoyed the podcast as much as it was fun going to Venice and attending the amazing conference at IM Architecture.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So we're going to start our round table. So we've invited some of the speakers that you've already seen today and some that you will see tomorrow. Really, it's just super informal, as you can tell by the alcohol up front. And some of it could be for you, too, if you ask questions. But, I'll start. I'll first introduce everybody, but I'm going to start off with a few questions that I've kind of prepared in advance. And then as we go forward, you know, feel free to raise your hand and we can ask the questions. So really, the intent here is to take advantage of the expertise we have on stage and get their opinions and thoughts on really anything. So let me do the intros first. So first, we've got Chris Nichols on the far end. He is the director of KS Group Labs in Los Angeles. Next to him, we have Scott DeWitty. He is, where's my notes? I keep forgetting them. There's firm-wide creative manager at Gensler. Lon Groves, he's the chief creative officer at KS Group. Next to him, we've got Christian Claussen, you saw this morning. He's the partner and director of CGI at D-Box in London. Dan Harper, who's the managing director at Cityscape Digital. We've got Luciana Carvalho, who's the chief evangelist at Reality Center London. And then last but not least, Patricio Navarro, who's the managing partner at ARX Solutions. And of course, myself, Jeff Model from CG Architect. So the first question I wanted to ask, and I've done a number of these panels in VR and AR in the last year, and I feel like every time I do it, the type of questions I ask kind of change because the technology has changed so fast. So somebody who's just thinking or, you know, trying to wrap their heads around how do they approach this, what are their clients looking for, given that it's changing so fast, how do you even decide, you know, what you should be targeting? I mean, which HMD, which software, how do you approach that? What's the best way forward to make sure you make the right choices? Because clearly not everybody's going to buy every HMD and every software and try to every experiment.
So you mentioned how much do you charge in there, and that interested me straight away. Well, obviously we charge as much as possible. And of course the question is, how do you charge as much as possible? And ARO was talking about this earlier. And of course, it's about, you know, what value are they going to get from it, really? And with the change of technology, the question is, what's the risk? Because the HMDs change so fast, software changes fast. And basically, as a service provider, you're kind of insulating them from that risk. So if they can build their building faster, better, set it globally from one digital file, it's worth quite a lot of money. And so we kind of try to get to that bit first and find out where is the most value for them. And then quite quickly you can see their appetite, and the bigger their appetite, the more we charge them. And as Aerox was saying, you've got the whole ecosystem from solution design all the way to helping them actually to do the retailing right at the end. And often people fall over right at the last minute because they don't know how to operate it in the sales and marketing suite. So, and if you can charge for all of those bits, then the bill's bigger. That's my thoughts.
So you were asking a question about, like, also how do you decide on those decision technologies, right?
Because it's changing so quickly.
Everything's changing so quickly. Yeah. So I think what's interesting about it is to actually, from my point of view, because I don't necessarily try to sell a service, we try to sort of look at different solutions based on technology. What I like is the fact that because what we do at KS Group, we make V-Ray, but V-Ray is used by a lot of industries. So architecture is just one of them, but we also have people in visual effects, we have people in automotive, we have people in product design. All of them have different ideas of what they want virtual reality to be, from making a movie in VR to showing off a car in VR, et cetera. And they all have different ideas, and what's really interesting is to hear all of their different ideas of what those VR solutions are for them and trying to figure out the commonality between them, because sometimes someone's idea would actually fit well for another industry, and they could learn from that. So combining all of that knowledge base and being able to say, hey, you know, I know you're working in this, but you should talk to the automotive guys because they're coming up with this solution, and that's going to serve you in some ways. So it's sort of combining the ideas of what virtuality is. And I think that architecture is extremely important, and obviously we can learn from other industries, but I also think that other industries can learn from us, because I think that's how we're going to be able to do that. And by doing that in terms of your cost thing, then we develop one solution that works for many different ideas. And then by learning from other solutions, we can actually reduce the amount of development that we do. Because you don't want to make something that's obsolete in 6 months, right? It sucks. So that's what I'm thinking about in terms of learning from other solutions.
We share that same approach in that at the Reality Center, we work at lots of different industry verticals. And one of the things that we've been trying to get as much as possible is organize a different format. So we'll do conferences on a regular basis, getting different stakeholders from the clients, the corporates that we work with, to investors, to policymakers, to developers, and from lots of different industries, and ask them about their problems. So like Dan said, we're very much about finding a solutions-driven approach to things, and seeing what will stimulate kind of really fast brainstorming. So we organize from conferences to hackathons, where we'll have a challenge, just kind of take it to the next level, and also on the flip side, we're constantly looking at, like you said, it moves so quickly that we would try to discern and make a list of sources that they can look to as well, which are reputable sources, and that keeps us up to date. So we're big fans of Voices of VR, like podcasts, to keep up to date with things, and the guys at VR Scout.
No, for us, we try to always test. So we invest a lot of money in terms of investing in research and development. But always we try to think, okay, no matter in fact how cool is the technology, we try to think from the end user. In fact, I remember one of the earliest tests that we included with Leap Motion, okay? And we had the possibility to navigate using our hands. So it was like flying. It was super cool, but it was so complicated. And said, well, again, grandmother is going to be able to do it? No, there's no way. So those kind of things that suddenly we discarded because we didn't find something useful from the end user. For us, we love it, okay? So that's the distinction. We try to test the technology and see, okay, what is something that we can use, or someone who is our current client or might be a client for ARX might be helpful. So we try to test everything. So we have every single device that we have, and we try to keep updated. And that is why sometimes we have so many obsolete hardwares and things, but anyway, it's part of the deal. It's part of the industry. So
then somebody who's in the architectural industry and thinking that they, they haven't yet implemented VR, or they're thinking about it, is the really the only way to start playing is to heavily invest and try everything?
No, I don't think so. I think that there's a lot of information available. The other day I was in several meetings in London, and I was impressed by how many architectural firms in London has the HTC Vive, for example. I think probably you find a lot of firms who are actually having in London HTC Vive. And all of them are, yes, we have an HTC Vive, it's there. When it was the last time that you run something? Well, we probably use it twice. So it was amazing. I think that many firms would like to implement technology, but they don't know how to. Okay, and they are very early birds. But at the end, they burn the technology in some cases, because having not the right skills in order to produce something. Okay, yeah, might be someone who is taking seriously and can provide a good solution, but that requires certain background that not everyone has. So I don't think that there's some at the same time. That is why it's so successful, the 360s, because they are part of the, in fact, what Chaos Group is actually doing. Chris and Goose, okay, are actually doing is basically working on something that is fully compatible with their production pipeline. And that is why it's so successful at the same time. So because the 360 is something that is... So anyway, I think that there's different approaches to different companies, some companies. I was impressed by what he did at Meccano. Okay, so I really like, I was impressed. So anyway, it's depending on who are the people, okay, behind the scenes.
This just reminded me of a conversation I had with some the lovely people at ThoughtWorks, but who also were, it's a co-working space based in Manchester and London, and they were all excited and called me up and said, oh, we just got one of those VR machines. What do we do? And obviously, and the guys in Manchester got them, so the guys in London felt left out, so they got it too. And they just had no idea. So it's about starting with the why, and I asked them, don't just get an HTC Vive for the sake of getting an HTC Vive. So we always come with this idea of start with why are you getting it?
Yeah, that's what I was going to add. Is even when we started out, we were just trying to identify problems that architects and people were having and try and give them a solution that is actually going to be more beneficial to them rather than having an animation or a load of still images when the VR would do the job that they're sort of asking. Try and do that, and then through the real estate, it's just, as people would say, it's a no-brainer because you've got all the information already in hand. Why not generate these places that some people will want to experience? It's not going to suit everyone, but generally, it can be a good sort of affordable solution for them.
Thank you. So I see, having watched the evolution of visualization happen in our industry over the last 20 years, I see a lot of parallels in the way technology has advanced, and I feel, what we had in the late 90s and early 2000s on how creativity for the most part was not an important part. It was the novelty of the technology, and that was what got everybody excited. And I see a lot of parallels to how VR is coming about right now. So I'm wondering at what point, especially given that there are people in our industry now that have seen that in the past and can reflect on it, at what point do we move away from the novelty of VR, both from a client perspective and even within our own companies, to a point where we're thinking more about the whys, are we doing it, and the storytelling and the creative aspects of VR, rather than just doing it for the sake of it being VR?
I wasn't around at the beginning of visualization, Jeff. I don't know what you're talking about. But I think actually the answer is sort of simple. It's fluency, right? It's you need to build your skill set so that you feel fluent with it. And that's the reason why, all those technological barriers, if you're spending all of your time trying to jump over hurdles, you're spending less time being creative, right? I mean, just as a matter of fact, the more, puzzles you have to solve. And we already have a lot of those challenges inherent in any visualization project. We've got to model it, we've got to texture it, we've got to light it, we've got to change it, up until the day that it goes out the door, right? So there are those barriers, too, that are challenges even just to do rendering. And so the more we become fluent and the more that we kind of get rid of those, the barriers in our mind or the barriers in the workflow, the more we're able to experiment with the creativity. Or the creative side.
I agree. I also think it's going to happen very naturally, honestly speaking. And Scott, you can back me up on this because you and I have had this conversation where you have the old time designer in the architecture firm and you want to put that VR headset on them and they are reluctant to put it on. And then finally they agree to put it on and they go, oh, wow. And then it's like, wait a minute, is that how high that window is? And then suddenly the conversation has changed. It's not about the technology anymore. Now it's suddenly the tool that they've been using, and it comes completely natural because they can finally see it to scale, right? They can finally see the right thing. And that's a natural transition. So really your barrier is just putting that darn headset on someone, right? that's your barrier to get that technology discussion out of the way, because the architect is not interested in necessarily talking about the architect, about the technology. They're interested in talking about the architecture. And then they get the headset on, they will start talking about the architecture again. I mean, you can pick me up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I've seen that countless numbers of times. Even some of my own internal principal staff were like, oh, this is a gimmick, this is a gimmick, this is a gimmick. I'm like, give me your latest project and give me 3 days, and I'm going to show you. And then, case in point, you put the headset on them, they're like, I need 10 of these headsets right now. Like, but I think we're on, I think, the cusp of what you're asking. I think the novelty effect is somewhat wearing off. And I think, one, this conference is a really good sign of that, because I think we're all here because we know the novelty, and now we're trying to get past that. And two, I've already started to see a lot of clients directly come to us asking very specifically for VR experiences for a very specific purpose. And so now our clients are becoming very educated in terms of what VR can do and what it is and how they can use it for their own use. I mean, there's still some where we put the headset on and they're like, whoa, like this is the coolest thing ever. But to that point, like the architects and designers, the second they put it on, I mean, novelty wears off real quick. And now it's a design tool for them. Client side, I think we're starting to see that switch.
So you and I have had this conversation before about the actual impact of VR on design, even within the firm. Maybe comment a little bit about that and just kind of that, how that process has changed and how it's evolving in terms of the actual design process.
Yeah, well, and then I alluded to this in my talk earlier today, but we have designers jumping into VR right out of the gate. And there are a lot of applications, and again, doing what Chaos Group is doing is like, we use V-Ray and Revit Rhino, SketchUp, and Max. And so we can create VR renderings at any point, at any time, because it's right against the process. You're not really doing anything more other than clicking a button saying, I want this in VR, and hitting render, and it generates an image. And then they put the headset on, and they can review. And there are other tools out there, like, again, Fuser and Enscape, if you're in Revit and want to do that. But, yeah, I mean, in the design process, because what designers and architects are doing, they're trying to design an experience, and they're trying to design, like, a place with volume. And doing that on a 2D screen and just looking at a 3D model, you don't get that. You just don't. But VR does deliver that kind of experience to you. And so really quickly, if someone's trying to determine if ceilings should be 8, 10, or 14 feet, well, you can generate a rendering or a live model real quickly and say, oh, no, 14 feet feels adequate for this space. Or if you're doing a big atrium, are you really trying, is that really coming across the way you want to? And so designers latch onto that real quick early on. And we'll even present that way, too. We won't do photorealistic VR renderings. It'll just be white box, maybe a little color here and there, and clients are still eating that up, too.
It's one of the things that I was trying to get at in the presentation is what you're talking about is the conversation, right? The conversation that happens because of VR. So instead of saying, here, put on this headset, say, can you tell me if the ceiling looks like it's the right height? Do you like the 8 foot, 9 foot, or 10 foot ceilings, you know, better? Like conversations that actually have meaning to somebody, they'll put on the headset and get in there because they'll want to answer that question. The other way to bait somebody who is an architect or a designer into being interested into VR is to put a model in there and model something wrong and give them the headset. And then as soon as they point out, well, that stair shouldn't do that, it shouldn't go, or that window, what the hell is that? You got them. You have them from then on out. They will want to look at, just to check what's happening in VR.
I had that kind of experience where I was talking with an architect, and he was like, okay, I'll just take you through all the floor plans of this big kind of complex. But I'd already had their model, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do some tests in VR and show them to him. But he sort of took me through first, and he was like, oh, it's quite complicated because there's lots of different level changes and ramps and slopes and mezzanines. And he took me through it, and I was like, yeah, I've stood there. I know exactly where all that goes. And I knew it better than he knew his own building. And then he showed it to me. He was just like, oh, my God, okay, this is brilliant. And that's how those conversations get started. I think my advice for people, going back to the previous question, is if you want to get a client excited, you've got to show them something that they've worked on. They know their project inside out, but actually if they can experience it before it's built, I think that's usually the hook, line, and sinker that you can get the buy-in for that.
So pretty much every response here in the last couple of minutes is really centered around collaboration and that discussion. Given that there are tools like Facebook's new, I can't remember the name of them, Spaces has come out, and there's a few others. How does collaborative design or even just collaborative communication within VR play into everything? And what have you seen, and what are you hoping it might become?
Funny enough, I was about to talk. We talked about creativity before. I think VR has just lifted the lid off how many dimensions of creativity are going to happen, and that's going to happen because we now have an enabled situation. So hardware is affordable, software is affordable. We now have location-independent collaborations now possible. So now you can get whoever you want from around the world to collaborate in a format which everybody and anybody can understand. So whether it's your granny, talked about the granny earlier, whether it's a talented designer, a futurist, whoever it is, wherever they are in the world, they can collaborate now. And so really the new dimension of creativity in order to actually leverage this is going to be facilitation. The question is, when you have all these people from around the world who know what they know in one space at one time, one place, how do you facilitate that? And through developing facilitation models of how you guide that discussion is how you really lift the value out of that discussion and turn that into faster production, more relevant production. I mean, for instance, we work a lot in property, and it's kind of interesting in property that the customer doesn't really have much of a say. In most other industries, if you're building a 100 million to 500 million pound thing, you don't really start doing it if we've done a focus group. So if you're pharmaceuticals, fashion, whatever, one of the people you go and ask first is the customer. And it's not the design doesn't know what they're doing. It's just the question is, to what are they applying their art of design? So I would say that we're going to see a big change in that dimension, so that rather than building 300 two-bedroom flats, and then afterwards we say, hey, do you want to move in? You're like, kind of. Do you want to move into a flat that looks like his flat? Makes for less interesting dinner parties. I know where your table is. No, your table's not in the same place. But this is going to completely change. It's going to invert the whole industry, because now we can go to the market and we can say, what kind of flat do you want to live in? And before, there was no point in having that conversation, because if you described it in words, I'd have no idea what that was. But if we could sit down in a live workshop in VR and make that experientially, iteratively, then we can now express that. We've done this at Cityscape. We could do that in sort of probably an hour. Now a brand or a supermarket, whoever, can say, what does my supermarket in the future look like? Well, they can get a nine-year-old. You can sit in a workshop. You can make it. And they couldn't possibly articulate that, but now they can express it. So I think as a collaboration, this is one of the areas that's going to start happening.
Maybe a bit more literally, in the terms of collaboration, are you physically in the same space, in the same virtual space as that collaboration is taking place? Not so much just the communication between the client, but are you physically in VR together in that discussion process?
Yeah, I think it would be. I mean, the sessions that we've done initially to test the facilitation concept have been in the same room. So we sat in the same room with live modeling. But of course, the power of the collaboration being that you can get the best person in the world wherever they are, so it's going to happen with people in the same virtual space. To be able to do that means, if you're making products, it means you could be making the next Ferrari, but you could be involving your customers before it's designed and say, hey, sit and seat the Ferrari and say, is that the Ferrari you want? Now, you don't have to change the design, but if it turns out that everybody agrees that this would be really cool, then you can actually do that. And of course, you can gather the data about how they're interacting with your product before you even started making it. So I think it's going to happen in virtual places.
Yeah, an example of a company that we've worked with and come across is Immerse Learning, based in the UK. And they work mainly on like big industries, so oil, gas, kind of really high risk submarines, and I think space shuttles now. But what they try to do is like you said, kind of really focus on collaboration and through different mediums. So they've got so say someone's training on a virtual oil rig, so they'll have two people that are training there, and a trainer that's looking at it through either a VR headset, and it can be, you know, two people are doing the Vive and they're on the gear, or they're actually just looking at it on a 2D screen. And they'll have people in the company also watching it on a browser. So it's kind of multi-platform, and you can have as many people from the company, you know, giving inputs. And also, I mean, that just takes training to a whole new level when you've got that, you know, immediate feedback from different participants. Another really cool collaboration that we've, or sort of training that we've seen on a social spectrum is Dr. Shafi. So in the healthcare space, there is a really cool surgeon called the virtual surgeon, and he's trying all different kinds of new social VR AR platforms, like even Snapchat. So he in a sense, the mission is to democratize his learning. So he'll live stream surgeries or live stream on Snapchat, so people all over the world can tune in and watch.
Just one more thing, because based on the discussion that's happened and your original question about the novelty of VR, I think the problem is that VR does seem like a novelty. And the reason it does is because it's surrounded by tech demos, right? So you put on a headset and it's a tech demo, or you put on a headset and they're showing you some VR movie, right? And that's a passive experience. It looks like a demo. It's not engaging you. And the whole nature of VR is a first-person interactive experience, something where you are able to interact with it. Architecture is a first-person experience. You experience it first-person. You know what's going on. You have that's why when you put the headset on, you make an architectural decision at that moment, or you experience it as a first-person. Or better yet, you interact with other people. Again, first-person experiences is a changing thing. So in order to get over the novelty, you have to get people to realize that it's not a tech demo. And while we all, as an architecture, everyone here knows this because we use it as a tool, but unfortunately, majority of the world out there, majority of the people that are creating VR are creating VR movies. And that's not the right use case for it necessarily. Right, Facebook just shut down their studio because no one's doing anything with it. So it's the actual interaction with people from all points of view that I think are important for us to realize the usefulness of it beyond the technology.
Make sure you stop by our tech demo tomorrow.
Just tacking something else onto end that. I mean, when we first tried to start selling VR experiences to people would come in, as you say, to a tech demo, and they'd sit there and they'd go, "That's really interesting," and then they'd walk out. We're like, "Whoa, stop, can't you see why it's so good?" And they couldn't see why it's so good. So what we did is then we turned all the screens off, hid all the equipment away, and then we'd start from the solution part that you were talking about, and we'd say, because it's property developers, it's just really easy. You just say to them, "How much more money would you like to make?" And they go, "A lot more money." And you say, "And quicker?" And they go, "Yes." And they say, "What is it?" We say, "Well, would you like to kind of focus with your customers and find out what they really want, make your brand more personal?" "Yes." "If you could design it faster, wouldn't that be great?" They say, "Yes." And they say, "What is it?" "VR." And then you turn the screen on. And then you have a look. And then you say, "Imagine I'm walking around with you." And it really did actually work. It was actually no more complicated than what I said, because we saw so many people walking out of the room because they thought it was a tech demo. And they're not listening to you because they're looking at the screen going, "Oh, it's kind of cool." But then they walk out. So as you say, is it a tech demo? No. And we still follow that now, and it works. It's got to be upside down.
Yeah, I think that going back to the question that you asked, I think that collaboration in many cases is the future. But there's a couple of things that future is going to bring new challenges as well. In fact, we have our tests that we did in house. It was for an Unreal Engine, and we set up a server. And basically, we connected the three offices, so we were able to see each other in the virtual environment. And it was super cool when someone in Buenos Aires did like something like this, and we saw it. So we shared this and to one of our clients, okay, high-end clients, and said, well, we are technically possible that we have the possibility technically to basically connect multiple users around the world. And in fact, he saw the test. We put one guy in Miami, one guy in Buenos Aires, and I was in Madrid. And long story short, the client said, yes, I think that this is quite impressive, but I can't see their faces. Well, this is super cool. Yes. You should be excited as we are. No, yes, but for a sales tool, I should be able to see the client's face, to see where is the other person. Oh. So those are the kind of new challenges that we are going to face in the future. And again, we are learning in the hard way, guys.
So one of the things that occurs to me when you were talking earlier, you mentioned about the service part in your presentation, which I think is really cool. And as the technology develops, as it changes, it creates these problems. But our view is that facilitation kind of fixes those problems. So sometimes we say to the developer, well, right now you can't see their face. So that means maybe we need to provide a service solution to that. So we will take the equipment to that location and then you do it face-to-face for now. Because when the technology comes in, sure, we can switch it out, but you're still going to sell faster and more personally. Because technology, we can't, you know, we're not investors in the technology directly, and we can't control it, even though we can be aware of it. So
maybe I'll ask one last quick question before we go out to some audience questions. Given that I think most people on this panel, and I would hazard to guess many people in the audience as well, are going to be responsible at some point very soon for hiring people to help bring their VR departments forward. What sort of things do you look for in the people that are going to be working on these projects, and what are some of the challenges you guys run into finding those people and training them or getting them up to speed?
They've got to be agile and think fast because it's all changing.
I think it's kind of identifying within the CG teams generally within our studio who are the people that really are interested in VR, because it's not everyone's cup of tea. We've got sort of animation, film, CG stills, and it's kind of identifying those candidates that really have that drive and that passion for VR. And that's kind of what you want to have in all those departments. You've got to be researching it, keeping on top of those sort of things. But it's probably the younger generation that will be more up to date with it, that will have that sort of more technical background, because that's what they're learning in universities now, I believe. And I think that's kind of building from the ground up.
Can they write in C++? No, I'm just kidding. I think the one thing that you need is curiosity. Curiosity is like the one, it's ingrained in people, right? So if you have that, and you will then be okay with the changing landscape, because you're going to be curious about what's next. So if that person is always wondering, okay, how can we improve this? How can we make what's... And actually, you want those people in all parts of your business, right? You want, well, not everybody. You do want some people to get some work done. But I think, to me, that's where we are right now, is to find the people that are passionate about going, okay, what door can we unlock now?
So echoing all of that, but I'm gonna get a little more technical, is that hire people who know how to code. I wasn't kidding earlier when I was talking about coding is a big deal. And working from a design firm, we don't have a lot of coders that know how to do any of this. We've got a lot of people who can design and model and make textures and make things pretty, but when it comes to start adding the interactivity and the scripts to do all kinds of cool stuff, we're lacking very hard. And so that's something I've been pushing at our firm, and we just recently actually hired an ex-Chaos Group guy who is one of their lead software engineers on V-Ray for Revit, who has a really good background in Unity, to start helping us design a lot of these tools internally and start working us in creating more dynamic experiences. And that's an interesting thing that the firm kind of had to come to grasp. I mean, they had a hard enough time with me not being an architect and just an illustrator and hiring me and trying to figure out how to keep me busy. And so our Chicago office went through that learning pain where they were like, oh, we want to hire someone like this. And I was like, don't hire a designer. And they found a designer who kind of knew how to code. and he wanted a design when he got to Gensler. I'm like, that's, I don't know why you guys thought that was going to work. So now they're actually, they just hired a Unity developer who actually starts on Monday. And so I think that's going to be the coming trend, that design firms need to start looking outside of the box when it comes to those employees, if they're really going to jump into this. It's like, you need to start hiring game developers. You need to start hiring software engineers. And the trick is on the other side too, is marketing to those people, because they're not looking at our industry for jobs. And so how do we make ourselves enticing to them is going to be a challenge as well.
And a good segue into what I was going to say, my background is law. So one of the things that that I'm very passionate about is kind of giving back to the people who took me in to tech, and kind of, and enabled me to, because of sheer curiosity and the fact that I shared the same vision and we're just aligned in my passion and curiosity. So we look for people who more on the potential side, and also focus a lot on diversity. So getting, how do we attract girls into, as you can see from the panel, running the Women in VR group, it's something I'm really passionate about, to get more girls to think, demystify the idea that coding is for a teenage boy who's wearing a hoodie in a dark room. Actually, it's not, and it's very, very cool. And so we do a lot of work going to secondary schools, because it seems like in the pipeline, the crucial point is when they reach, so it's, apparently it's a 50-50 split interest in coding and computer science and software engineering. And then when they get to about 11 or 12, that's when puberty hits and society pressure and stereotypes and all that. So we do a lot of work on making sure that the VR community is as diverse and inclusive as possible.
Hooray for girls in technology. Yes, please. I think it's really important, but there is a parallel to this. I just remember from the early days of visual effects, because as some of you may know, I've worked in architecture and I've worked in visual effects, but in the early days of visual effects, it was the same problem, right? There was no one who really knew. Like, the only way to work in visual effects back in 1993 is you had to have an SGI and you had to have Wavefront or Softimage or whatever it was. And just that setup alone cost you $150,000 before you hired the artist, right? And there's no artist, because who has access to that to learn it? So no one knew the technology. They basically say, here you go, and by the way, we'll pay you a lot of money, but we don't know how to use this machine either. So you had to figure it out. You had to do it on your own. And so they hired people with curiosity. They hired people with drive. They hired people from all kinds of industries. I mean, one of the guys I worked with at DD in the early days, he has a PhD in aeronautics, right? I don't know how he ended up in visual effects, but his knowledge base is really useful when I'm trying to make a rocket for Apollo 13, right? So those types of things are important. There's a lot of architects that went into it because they had knowledge of 3D. There's a lot of people from makeup effects that got into it because they saw their trends kind of going away. So I think just curiosity, or just the idea of what it is, and importing people from other industries like you're doing, bringing some programmers into an architecture firm, I think is great. I think that's what we need to do.
I think it needs definitely hire a strategist. That's fairly high up the list, because we're dealing in a world where everybody can understand what VR does. So now suddenly everyone's got a window into this. It's location independent. Software and hardware is changing. The industry hasn't been formed yet. So I'd hire a strategist, maybe a female.
So maybe we'll grab a few questions from the audience here, because we've probably got about maybe 5-10 minutes left. So just a show of hands for a question, and we'll have the mic run out to you.
Do you want us to ask you questions?
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, the VR and AR industry it's incredible. I mean, I've worked with it for a few years, and I'm hoping to work with it for so many years to come. But one of the main things that we struggle with is mass adoption. I mean, we have the Google Cardboard, which probably everyone can buy. But what do you think will be pinnacle event that will cause everyone to actually be able to have a VR headset at home, or is it not to have a VR headset that will actually make everyone have a VR experience?
I think that is a difficult question, but in my personal opinion, as soon as Apple release their headset, everyone will start using virtual reality. So, of course, we were expecting to have the headset of the last iPhone. I was highly disappointed by this. I think that as soon as Apple, okay, that's a leader company in the technology industry, assume that leadership, everyone else is going to adopt. So that is why I think that there's going to be a break-even point. Many reasons, many sources, as she said, okay, probably the next iPhone is going to be a revolutionary, many things. There's one thing that I learned the other day that it was quite interesting. Did you know that Apple changed the years? Okay. Do you know why? Because they have a device there that is for augmented reality and is in the headset. It's in the ears. So in order to prepare and seed the field, they already introducing the iPhone 7. So the ones who have the 7 in the ears, you can have that device that is not connected yet. So it means that pretty soon are going to be releasing something like that. So I think that as soon as Apple catch this, everyone else are going to start with, because Apple is putting money in that direction. Many sources indicate that that is going to happen pretty soon.
Actually, I think that's very close to what I would answer, right? But here's the reason. Here's the additional reason why. The most successful headset that we've seen so far is the Gear VR. And we saw that on the amount of devices. The reason that it's successful is it actually does, it gives you the best for the least entry point, right? The Google Cardboard is the lowest entry point, and it works on all phones, but it's not a great experience, right? And it's not enough to really grab you. But the Gear, I've seen people go, holy shit. And it's the first one that you can do scale. So the problem is that Gear only works on the few Samsung headphones or the Samsung glass mobile phones. Then you've got the Daydream, which should be great, but it only works on a few, right? So the reality, I think, is absolutely true, is the minute that we have a device that's equivalent to a Gear VR that's pretty good, at a $99 or $199 or whatever it's going to be. If it's Apple, it's $499. But if it works on all of our phones, including the iPhone, which is leading the market in terms of the amount of mobile penetration, then you've got something that will reach critical mass.
I 100% agree. I also think it's got to be a good experience, right? And that's the thing. Like, for example, everyone thought that when the iWatch, it's not the iWatch, what is it called now? Watch. The Apple Watch. When the Apple Watch came out, everyone thought everyone's going to have an Apple Watch. Now, there's a lot of Apple Watches out there, but it certainly did not take off the way that people thought, because the experience was not necessarily favorable, something that Apple doesn't always do. But it happens every now and then that the experience isn't very good, or it's not necessarily what people expect it to be. So then it didn't take off as much as it should have, and I think you have to have great experiences for people want to go into VR, want to be there. And I think that's the responsibility of people like us, everyone in this conference, to make great experiences. Because again, I don't like the Netflix app on the Gear VR either, because it's ugly. Sorry, but it's really, really ugly. And we work with great designers, great architects. Some of us are great architects. We know what something beautiful should look like. And it should not look like the Netflix app on the Gear VR. It should look better than that. that's a responsibility. And if someone puts on the beautiful iPhone augmented VR, whatever it is going to be, they put that headset on and they get the Netflix experience, it's not going to work. It's going to fail. So we have to create great experiences for it to succeed as well.
And so I think I'll echo on all of this a little bit. I agree that I think when Apple puts a VR headset out, it's going to explode a little more, but I can't see Apple really doing anything different that's already there. So like Chris said, content's going to drive it. And so unless Apple's got something up their sleeves in terms of experience, I don't see it being that terribly successful. I mean, yeah, sure, everyone who owns the new phone and whatnot can probably go out and buy one, and I'm sure you'll get the buy one, get one free deals potentially through some of the carriers. But I really think when someone solves the how do I tell a cinematic story, or someone does some kind of entertainment gaming experience that really hits home to VR, I don't think you're going to see it take off. Because the only other people who are really generating a lot of content for VR are the people in this room, and that's not consumer level. So it's going to be whenever someone, I feel like finally hits that nail on the head on terms of just content, that's when we're going to see that shift. Whereas it's like, I have to go out and buy this now so I can experience this. And that's really going to be the breaking point, I think.
I'm just going to be controversial here. I don't think that Apple's is going to be that good, because I think they're lacking Steve Jobs. I think he was the vision behind a lot of Apple's great stuff, and I think they're really kind of missing that.
I think for mass adoption, you need a couple of factors to be in line at the same time. I don't think everything has to work the same or have the same technology. There has to be a real compelling value, as is mentioned earlier. And I think if there's a really tight business model, then these companies will pour tons and tons of money into solving all these problems. I suspect they're sitting on one side saying, what really is the value that we are going to experience by everybody being able to have VR on their phone? At the same time, the consumer's wondering, well, what was the point of having VR on my phone? So when it's in that state, neither party's moving. But if you consider that, imagine from a brand's point of view, imagine being able to track how someone's interacting with a future product, potentially where they're looking, where they go, what they do, where they don't look, and you get all that data, collecting data you've never been able to get hands on before, raw behavioral data from a customer. Now, you can work with a data model, it doesn't take very long to work out how much money's in there. For the consumer, the question is, well, why would I want to do all this stuff? What's the value? Well, it could be entertainment, great entertainment. It could also be that if the next Samsung phone or next iPhone has a little scanner on it, for instance, so I can scan my kitchen and I can upload my kitchen model to IKEA's website. I can choose a kitchen, it lays it out for me. Then it pushes that out to the fitting company, who don't have to measure anything, come visit you because they've got dimensions. So they come and fit it and it actually works. That would add value to the customer. They're going to want to, they'll put the headset on, not because they enjoy putting the headset on, because it saves them going all the way to the store, screwing around with the people at IKEA. And then the fitter comes and says, we thought it was 1.5 meters across, but it's actually 1.3, so we're going to go back to the factory. You just have to provide a compelling reason, and sometimes the utility is enough to get people to do something that's not attractive. So I think it's actually about creating a business model that looks at a data side, because data is huge and well understood, and it's looking at proximity, time-saving, utility. And if you get that lined up, then, of course, when a brand's got that model down, they will pour the money in, because they do that times X equals, right, maybe Samsung are advertising that, primetime TV. And they're effectively starting to do that now.
Yeah, I was just also going to add quickly, for what we've seen, it's kind of like I like to draw the parallel with a smartphone, for example. So if this didn't have any apps on it and it just called and stuff, we wouldn't be like we are, basically. And the same kind of equivalent thing needs to be definitely driven by a compelling reason, by applicability, usability on a day-to-day basis. And until we get that, and I think, which is why I was beating the drum for social VR, it's something that about bringing us closer together. Yes, it's entertainment and also applicability from the commercial standpoint. But I also think something like, the most used apps on our smartphone are Facebook, Messenger. So it's a way of bringing people together. And until we have something that's the equivalent of, say, Skype in VR, where my parents are in Portugal, but we get to meet in VR and play a game, and he can be in VR and share, you know, stories with my godson who's in Brazil. So when that happens, now I think that will be the kind of magic leap.
I would like to add something regarding to the Apple stuff. And the reason why I believe that Apple, okay, is going to at least going to move the market, okay, is because probably I believe that 90% of the clients of our clients has an iPhone. Okay, so the very high end, Apple is by far the leader. So we were having some problems in US, okay, because we provide a lot of solutions in US. And having Samsung, it was a big problem for us. And I believe that as soon as this becomes a solution, that is something that every single person who has an iPhone XX are going to be able to have their own experience in the, again, the client of our clients, okay? That is going to be a new empowerment for them. And that is why I believe that is going to be a deal breaker in some way, because most of our clients are going to be able, otherwise right now they need to have a Gear VR. How many of the clients of our clients has a Gear VR in the, because they don't have a Samsung. But if they are going to get this solution, they are going to purchase for 100 Xbox, okay, or 120 or whatever is going to be the cost. And I believe that that is going to bring a new opportunity, because basically it's going to become massive.
Yeah, but sorry, but your client is 0.01 of the population, right? So there are still millions or billions of people that are not that rich. And so those people want to experience VR, and that's the important thing. Now, Apple did succeed, and you're right. I'm bringing back to your point of, like, the apps are what succeeded. But when people don't necessarily remember this, but when the iPhone 1 first came out, there were no apps. It had no apps on it at all. In fact, Apple was adamant about not opening up that experience to anyone else. They wanted to control the market, control the experience, control everything. Why did they do that? Back to your question, Steve Jobs, right? Steve Jobs wanted to make sure people had high quality content on the iPhone and useful stuff. And when they did open it up, it was 90% fart apps, right? So fart apps are the bad phone experience. Kind of bad. People were selling them for 99 cents and trying to be millionaires overnight. And that's not necessarily what it is. And right now, the VR experience is people making bad VR experiencing, thinking they're going to be billionaires overnight. And that's the problem right now with the VR experience. And I think that higher quality, thought out experiences that are meaningful are what's going to help out for sure.
And onto that note too, like, I actually just switched from Apple to Samsung. And I didn't buy a Gear VR headset with my phone. I mean, I looked at that $100 price tag and was like, no. I mean, I have one, right? You guys saw me with it earlier, but that's for work, and I use it for work because the use case I have it is for work. But when I browse the store and see what apps are there and what games, absolutely nothing. So I told myself, like, what am I going to use this for personally at home? Why do I need to spend this $100 for this headset? And I couldn't justify it. Like, I was just like, sure. I was 4 days late on getting the headset for free when I bought my phone, of course, right? I know, so mean. so then I had to sit there at the AT&T store, and I was like, do I need to buy this? And I was like, no. There's absolutely no reason for me to buy this headset right now. And I have the same feelings. Like, that's what's going to happen with Apple. If they don't have anything backing it, you're going to get everyone who's Apple fanboy runs out and buys it day one. Hands down. Some of the clients, those top 1%, hands down, won't go out and buy it. They'll justify it like crazy. No doubt about it. But after that quick burn, after the honeymoon phase is over, what happens with it? And that's up to us. So, that.
So on that note, given that we're a little bit over schedule, and I think everybody's getting a little bit hungry and would probably like some drink, I want to thank all of our panelists for hanging out with us, and thanks for your question. So I think we'll wrap it up. and we'll head outside and grab some drinks. And these guys will be around today and tomorrow, so feel free to run up to them and continue the conversation. Thank you.
And thank you to our moderator.